What's going on, everybody? My name is Courtney Steven, and this is another episode of the Come Up Podcast, where we bring you the steps to success. And today, it's going to be a lot more of the same. Today, I'm talking to one of the USA's top business leaders, Chris Hallberg, who is the author of The Business Sergeant's Field Manual. And Chris is a husband and a father from Denver, Colorado, who serves as a leadership and management coach to entrepreneurs and their leadership teams all across the country. Chris's 20 years of business leadership are enough credibility to sit in the boardroom with anybody, but what makes his approach to leadership unique are the strategies, tools, and lessons that he learned during his time in the military and working in law enforcement. So today, we're going to learn all about Chris and try to extract some useful wisdom from his story in the short time we have together. So let's get right into it. So Chris, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Courtney. Thanks for having me on your show.
Hey, it's always a pleasure to be surrounded by good people. You know, they say you're the sum of the five people you hang out with most. So we try to bring on some people who could rub off on us.
Yeah, that's a great statement there. I wholeheartedly believe that you basically are a composite of those five people you surround yourself with.
Mm-hmm. So I feel like I want to go back and before we even get into, you know, the business and, you know, the strategies and those kinds of things, I want to know a little bit about, you know, who you are and what brought you to knowing all of these things that you know about leadership and whatnot. So I think one of the most interesting things to always start with is like, how did you get to, you know, what inspired you to join the military?
Well, I think like most young men, I was lacking some direction in my life, had a lot of energy, come from a long line of military service, fathers, grandfathers, you know, many, many generations. So I was automatically kind of drawn to the pomp and circumstance, you know, military rank structures, the uniforms, digging through my dad's old stuff. You know, so I just always had an affinity for military service. And, you know, when I, 2 weeks after high school graduation, I was in Army basic training and, you know, really gave me a lot of discipline and focus and really taught me about systems and how using systems can help you, you know, propel you in life, not just in your business life, but in your personal life. So I was always, you know, attracted to leadership positions ever since I was, you know, a little guy. You know, I was always leading some sort of trouble in the neighborhood. Sure. And, you know, just a natural inclination, you know, people person, you know, love building relationships and, you know, succeeding as a team, to me is always sweeter, you know, than any individual success.
Most definitely. So, you said that you were somewhat of a leader even when you were younger. And I know that leadership skills can be developed, but do you think that some people have an affinity to become a leader or some people have a natural talent for leadership? Or do you think it's something that is purely honed over time?
Well, I think it, you know, we're all products of our environment, Courtney, right? So if you grew up in a household that, you know, where there was a leader and someone who mentored and encouraged you and you were able to model leadership behaviors from someone else that you were close to, you know, I think you've got obviously a leg up, you know, having that proximity and having that resource versus not. But I think leadership is kind of a mindset, right? You know, a lot of people don't really want to fuss with it. They want the title, they want the corner office, they want the parking spot. But they really don't care that much about, you know, making other humans better or succeeding as a team. So, you know, if you want to lead people, there's generally a deep-seated reason why, because life's a lot easier being a follower than it is being a leader. That's for sure.
Well, yeah, I think that's profound on so many levels. And I feel like at some point in time or another, you know, we're all going to find ourselves in a situation where we have to follow somebody, you know, to some extent. During your time in the military specifically, or even in law enforcement, did you come in contact with some people who really, you know, stood out to you and exemplify what a great leader was?
Absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, you model those behaviors, right? So we've all had great leaders. We've all had crappy leaders.
Right.
And from the crappy leaders, you basically say you learn what not to do. And I think there's a lot of examples of really bad bosses out there. Everyone's got plenty of good, you know, shitty boss stories or whatever.
But right.
At the end of the day, somebody that took you under their wing, mentored you, was an example, put the team in front of themselves. You looked up to them. You you know, figuratively, you know, take a bullet for them, kind of that kind of a person. You know, those people are few and far between. Maybe top 20%, let's call it, of all leaders are anywhere close to that, you know, last description. Majority of leaders are in the first description, but, right. but you know, that's what I do is I help people, you know, get into that top 20% and see leadership differently. You know, it's servant leadership that I teach.
Right.
And being a leader is very rewarding, but those rewards come from watching others succeed because of, you know, of you propelling them and mentoring them. And if you're not really excited about that, you know, you shouldn't really be a leader. You could be a subject matter expert or a lead worker or a senior person. But, you know, if you're not going to lead, manage, and hold, you know, people accountable for the betterment of the team, you know, that's where that commitment to be a leader really comes into play.
Right. And you hit on some really key points there. You're talking about, you know, it sounded like having a passion for leadership and really all the things that go with it, being excited to have the opportunity to lead, you know, and to work with people, servant leadership, and really getting in there and being a part of the team and not just pointing out direction. So what do you think are some of the things that excite you most about having an opportunity to lead? Is it to see people, you know, grow and develop? Is it really more about deliverables and the projects that you do? Or like what really gets you going when it comes to like leadership?
Well, I think it's all those things, you know, at the end of the day, you know, solving complex problems, you know, unblocking a team and, you know, to see them struggle and be frustrated and whether it's offering advice or guidance or, you know, working on their critical thinking skills or, you know, just kind of talking through it and asking questions. You know, a great leader just doesn't tell people what to do. They ask them smart questions to change the mindset and the mind frame of the person being led so they can learn the skills. You know, you can give somebody a fish and feed them for a day, teach them how to fish, feed them for a lifetime. It's the same thing in leadership. So it's about setting up the conditions and then saying, okay, have you thought of this? What about that? And you ask five or six decent questions, and they'll pretty much solve their own problems once you show the framework and how you do it. The formula, like anything else, the system.
Right. So it's something that is repeatable, basically. Once you've got the idea and the framework down, it's something that you can, you know, apply to multiple different places, like you've done it in multiple realms.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point is to nail it, then scale it, right? That's the whole idea. So you have to have... you have to figure out what you need to do before you can scale it to any size. So being a great leader when you're small is going to help you, you know, be a great leader when you're a medium company and when you're a big company. These aren't skills that you have to learn once you achieve a certain scale. These are skills, if you're just one person, you still have vendors, you still have suppliers, you have clients. There's a lot of people that need to be led, even if they don't, you know, have a W-2 and work for you, per
se. Right. And no, you got to nail it before you scale it. I like that one. I'll definitely credit you, but I'm stealing that one for sure.
No, I was going to say that's not mine. a client of mine, Boulder, Colorado, a famous entrepreneur named Bill Flagg is where I stole that from. So I'll give Bill credit. And I don't know who he jacked it from, but...
That one definitely resonates because I find that, you know, I'm a small business entrepreneur myself, and many of my friends, my colleagues, some of the people that I deal with day to day, a lot of people have businesses and brands popping up. It's easier to get into that kind of thing these days with technology being at our fingertips and whatnot. So, you know, the scale of what it took to open a business is not necessarily the same barriers as it was for maybe my parents' generation and whatnot. But what I find is, a lot of these businesses seem to be run on instincts, and there's not much of a system, or the organization doesn't have much organization, if you know what I mean. So how important is it in your experience and just with the people who you deal with, how important is it to really develop that system, like you're saying, so that you can nail it and then scale it?
Yeah, I mean, how important is breathing? You're right. Oxygen's kind of important to have that if you're a human. I joke about it, but you know, as a business coach, you know, I teach a holistic business operating system called EOS, or the Entrepreneurial Operating System. This system was developed by my now good friend Gino Wickman, outlaid in his book called Traction: Get a Grip on Your Business. This is a best-selling business book. If you haven't read it, you just have to. It's literally the silver bullet for business, if there was one. So basically, it's think about an operating system on your smartphone. Without it, it's a paperweight. There's a ton of great apps, but if they can't think together and talk together and, you know, use different parts of the phone, you know, it doesn't give you the results. Same thing. And really, when I came across this operating system, when I was working with a particularly troubled client in a turnaround situation, someone said, "Hey, have you seen this? You know, this, based on what you're describing, the system sounds like it, you know, it's a big hammer that can hit a lot of nails." So now all my coaching clients that I work with, first agreement is, "Hey, you have to agree that we're going to implement EOS into your company because it just solves so many other problems." Mm-hmm. We can then spend our time together, you know, working on the one-off high-up issues that, you know, the system indicates, but, you know, you might need some coaching past that. But I find that, you know, 136 problems that businesses have are the same 136 problems. And when you implement a business operating system like EOS, for instance, you know, you can at least get your arms around it and know where to be looking versus just standing at the whole thing, not knowing where to start.
Right. So you have a system that helps you develop, you know, the smaller systems within a business, because like you're saying, pretty much it doesn't matter what service or product that you're, you know, creating, whatever value you're delivering to the end consumer, like your business has to have certain components in it regardless. And if it's not a well-oiled machine, sooner or later, the wheels are going to fall off.
Yeah. I mean, the six key components of EOS, just real quickly, and the degree you can strengthen each of those six key components kind of determine your quality of life and business. Because if you know, were to make the analogy of a body, I joked about oxygen before, right? Let's call that, you know, sales in a business, right? You know, and mm-hmm. cash flow, blood flow, you know, respiration, you know, you could take all these bodily things. Humans, you know, we need water and food, and, you know, there's a few things that we kind of need. It's the same thing with your business. EOS talks about six key components, the vision component, you know, getting everybody on the same page, how you're going to get there. The people component, putting the right people in the right seat. Right people share your core values. Right seats means they get, want, and have the capacity to do the job, you know, literally the best you can find. The data component, getting rid of the egos and the subjectives and the personalities and boiling the organization down to a handful of numbers, because the numbers never lie. Mm-hmm. You know, once you have strong vision, strong people, strong data, you're open, honest, lucid. And problems or issues stick out like a sore thumb, which is the fourth key component, you know, just creating an open and honest environment to solve your business problems. Having a process component, the fifth key component, where you're documenting the 20% that gives you the 80%, think checklists, outlines, millennial friendly stuff. And then traction component, and that's just bringing the vision down to the ground and making a reality. And we do that by creating that 90-day world. Dr. Stephen Covey talked about rocks. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you make your company better? How do you change the wheels on the moving bus, Jim Collins says. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we create a 90-day world, then we create a meeting pulse, and we cancel a bunch of meetings that are not hard-hitting, actionable meetings, and we prepare for one Super Bowl of business meetings every week called the Level 10 meeting. And that's where you get your traction and the discipline, the accountability, and the gamification, and the healthy competition within your teammates happens. And once you have a system like that, it's a lot easier to go after it and get that, because most businesses fail or aren't able to execute because those six key components are in poor shape. So they're working on, you know, I'd like to joke, you're working on the 14th story of this building and your foundation sucks. So
right.
You put up 15, 16 floors, whole thing's coming down. So mm-hmm. it's about making sure you got a great foundation so you can then build a, you know, scale a business on that.
Right. And then as you get more familiar with each component, like you just rhyme those off. I'm sure you don't have a paper in front of you reading a script. It's just what you do, and you do it so often that it's familiar. And I love the book because for me, I like to read as much as the next guy, but sometimes it's easier when it's laid out in a structure where I could read two pages, get a point, and then I can go and try and apply that, right? So the way that the book is broken down, it's like 82 lessons put together throughout, I think, like 12-ish chapters. So there's mm-hmm. a lot of opportunities for you to kind of stop and then think about the practical application of the things you're talking about. And one of the things, well, there's a few that I'm going to go back over, but you talked about like this level 10 meeting, and that's towards the end of the book after you've explained most of the other theories going into it, like rocks, for example. Mm-hmm. And the rocks are basically the big things that move the needle, right? You're getting away yep. all the minutia, and you're dealing with, all right, what's going to allow us to do something that we can't do right now, right? So where'd you get that concept of rocks from?
Yeah, Dr. Stephen Covey coined the phrase, I want to say in the 80s or 90s, a long time ago. And his point was, you know, if everything's important, you know, nothing's important. So rather, I know you got 37 strategic initiatives, meaning things you want outside your day-to-day, your current reality that puts you in that future state. And most companies take 35 things and they get maybe two of them done and 20 of them half done. And then they don't do anything with them. And it's an epic waste of time. This is about saying, hey, what are the 3 to 7 most important things for this next 90 days? And again, whether you're talking about military backwards planning or EOS planning or strategic planning simplified anywhere, once we know where you want to be in 10 years and 3 years and 1 year, it's a lot easier to figure out what we need to be working on this quarter with the context mm-hmm. of those higher, you know, year goals. If you're just saying, hey, what do I need to do? What's right in front of my face? You know, you're really not being that strategic. It seems proactive, but it's actually reactive. But when you create that grander vision and then you chop that up into, you know, bite-sized chunks, what is the correct order? What do we need to get done here before this can be worked on? See, it's like building a house or a commercial construction. It's like a Gantt chart, if you're familiar, which is just basically a bunch of lines that show the order of how things need to happen so mm-hmm. you can successfully execute them.
Right. So there's like a difference in working in your business and working on your business. I find that's like a concept that a lot of leadership professionals talk to for entrepreneurs, because it's easy to get tied up in that day to day, you know, just making mm-hmm. sure things run the way that they're supposed to. But it's hard to grow if you're always worried about the small little details that aren't necessarily moving the needle. So another thing that I liked about the book was how many, charts or checklists or, you know, you just lay it out there so you can easily see, all right, these are the things when we go into this meeting, these are the things we need to address. This is how much time we're going to spend on them. And then we can keep it moving. We have a structure for how our train of thought is even going to move. So how important is it? Once you establish a list like that, you don't really have to go back and change the structure once your system is set up. So I guess it's very important to set that up. But then how important is it to kind of stick to the plan? I know that's hard for me to do, to stick to the plan sometimes, because an issue will pop up and you'll want to spend more time on that. But you have a plan that, you know, this is allocated, like you said, 20, 80, you know, we're going to spend a little bit of time here. Then we're going to go over there. So we make sure that we hit over all of our goals. How important is it to stick to the plan once you've kind of developed, you know, your rocks and, you know, your agenda for what you want to attack?
Well, I'd qualify it. Well, it's very important, but that's provided you have a good plan, right? So if your system works and the vision is becoming a reality, it's easy to stick with it because you're seeing the results. You had, here's me before this process, this mindset, and here's me after. Which one serves me and my people better? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is the new one, well, then it's a little easier. Mm-hmm. I mean, losing weight's easy. Eat less, exercise more. Yet, you know, I'd like to be, you know, 10, 15 pounds lighter, especially since the holidays, right? So, mm-hmm. but at the end of the day, there's a system for me to be 10% body fat. It's just I'm not willing to follow that system, you know, because I'm 45 years old and that's not important to me right now. Right. But at the end of the day, if running a business, you know, with consistent, scalable results is important, and you're tired of just forest fire fighting at the office daily, dealing with stupid people issues, right, and, you know, a culture that's not working, high turnover, low profits, how's that working? This no system thing is the alternative.
Right.
And that's something I picked up in the military and paramilitary organizations that I worked with in law enforcement, was there's a system for everything. Because if you don't follow it, you know, somebody's going to get hurt.
Right.
And you don't want to be the cause of that. It's one thing to get yourself hurt. It's another thing to get somebody else hurt because you weren't doing the right thing at the right time.
Totally.
And obviously the stakes aren't necessarily that high in business, but it's okay if we call it the things that are important to us and take business a little bit more seriously. But, you know, to answer your question more directly, you know, there's safety in the system. If the system indicates, hey, we should have this conversation or we should do something about that, you have to physically say, no, I'm not willing to do that. I don't want to do that. I'm not going to follow the system. And everyone's going to make a note of that. Mm-hmm. And eventually, if we're passing on those opportunities to solve issues and move your business forward, well, the business issue can be called out, right? In this case, it would be that person who's reluctant to do that, those things. So the point is, when we all agree, this is our vision, this is where we're going, this is how I'm going to be held accountable, this is how you're going to be held accountable, and anytime something slides out of that happy zone there, we're going to have an uncomfortable conversation. And at the end of the day, it's just a business issue. Let's not take this personal and get upset. You know, let's just do what we need to do. If you're not willing to do that, then we'll find somebody else and we'll wish you, you know, a goodwill in your future endeavors. So that's what a system is everyone agreeing these are the rules and the rules are good for the team.
Right. You know what? That reminds me, one of my football coaches always used to say, hey, look, man, if you're not right for the job or you can't get the job done, it doesn't mean I don't like you. You know, we can still go get a drink, but you're just not going to work here anymore.
Yeah. That's the mentality, you know, that I talk about in the book, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, talk about diversity. Diversity is a great thing in the workplace. I think the workforce should mirror the people you serve, as closely as possible. What's not cool is value diversity. If you value something completely different than what I value in a business setting, it's going to be really hard for us to be successful together as coworkers. So, you know, I believe we've gotten too inclusive from a value perspective. And when you get a bunch of people in the room that all want the same thing, and this is how we want to do it together, that makes sense. Work is fun. You just don't have those incompatibilities with personalities. Somebody walks in the room and everybody clams up. That's not good for anybody, right? Not, you know, the person who walks in to get the silence, you know they don't fit. Life's way too short for them to be miserable, for you to be miserable.
Mm-hmm.
To play this a few lines further, what about the person that's stuck at some other company that's miserable there? And this team would be like a breath of fresh air for them. They would be an amazing contributor. We're stealing the opportunity from them. So everybody's, it's not working for everybody. Yet people just try to find a way to jam these square pegs into the round holes. And it's just way too much work.
Mm-hmm.
So I think your coach was, you know, right on the money. And I coach a very similar message to the executives that I work with.
Right. And I think that gets to, you know, it's a touchy subject, but in the book, it talks about be slow to hire and be quick to fire. And I mm-hmm. think that goes for, you know, people, but also ideas. In my opinion, that's not necessarily what's mm-hmm. written. But I think, for example, if you have an idea that you really love, but it's not working out in the way that is going to benefit the business, I feel like that's something you would have to swallow that pill and take the emotions out of it, like you're saying, and be accountable to the people who are around you, because, you know, it's better to cut one bad idea or get one bad apple out of the bunch than to have everybody go down in the sinking ship. Would you say?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, that's what we call the good idea fairy. And the good idea fairy shows up and has an idea, and everybody goes, okay, we'll try that. But, you know, it's pretty clear after even a little bit, this isn't going to fly. When we focus on our ego or our political capital and this idea really sucks, but exactly, we're going to drive this right into the dirt because that's what we do here. That's not healthy. You know, the lowest person on the totem pole should call this out and say, how the heck does this even, you know, this has never been done before. You know, this is outside of our core focus. It's shiny stuff, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody calls that out, senior leadership's got to say, you know what? They're right. This is kind of something that's getting in the way of what we're actually really good at and what people need us to do. So I think when all decisions are used with the filter, you know, of your simplified strategic planning, then it's like, hey, that's not crazy. That's in the sweet spot of what we do. It's nuanced. It's new. Let's try it for a while. Let's A-B test it. There's nothing wrong with A-B testing ideas and putting them in the cage match and seeing which one's better. But when one's the loser, you got to retire that one. You can't hold on to it.
Mm-hmm. So you use a kind of moving, changing topics a little bit. You use an acronym in the book that I kind of like. I used to say when I was in college, I walked on to my football team. And so every day I had to kind of prove myself. So in my locker, I put up a piece of tape that said GID, like get it done. Because I had a specific task and I had to, you know, follow through on an objective that was, it was about 8-12 months long, but I had to make sure every day I knew. But in the book, you talk about GSD. What's that stand for?
Get stuff done or get shit done, depending on what audience you're in front of. And then I take the GSD thing. Another thing, I say GRSD. I have a lot of clients who have adopted the GRSD as a core value. Get the right stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
Because just getting stuff done, and everyone's busy and everyone's working. Wow, look at the activity. But who's really moving the needle here, you know, mm-hmm. with the business? So I find that when people adopt the get the right stuff done mentality, they can question, hey, is this really the best use of my time? Or this thing over here that isn't as fun, isn't as glamorous, but really does add to the business, that's the thing I should be working on. And when you give people, especially junior people, license to question that, you end up working on the right things when you make it okay to question working on the wrong things.
So then you regularly have to go back and, you know, put controls in place to see, well, we have goals and that's a great first step, but we also have to measure the objectives or the outputs from the effort we're putting forward.
Yeah. What moves the needle? If it doesn't move the needle, then let's stop doing that and put our human energy towards something that's going to have more of an impact on the business.
You know what? I honestly think that some people don't even know what their needle is, because these days there's a lot of vanity metrics where, you know, you can get, I mean, digital marketing is something that's easy for a lot of people to use in their business because there's a low barrier to entry. So especially in my personal generation, not too many people got a brick and mortar business because whatever, leases, different things like that, they have, you know, a higher monetary barrier to get in there. So people can set up online stores, for example, and then mm-hmm. they're going to look at the success of their online store in terms of maybe, you know, hits on their website. And while hits on their website may be a metric that's tied to their success, but it may not be. So it's important to know exactly what your needle is. Would you say, like, to kind of do the research to find out what are your revenue generating activities? What actually is your needle? I think that's a part of the system. Kind of that's a question phrased.
Yeah, I mean,
as
that's a huge part of the, you know, the EOS system is that weekly scorecard metric. It's forward looking.
Mm-hmm.
So before I started teaching the system, I fell into kind of that same trap where, okay, let's look at your financials. What was the gross profit? What was the net profit? Hey, what were our general administrative costs? Hey, can you give me expenses on this, right? So that already happened, right? And the numbers are not usually until halfway through the trailing month. So, you know, Rome could be on fire for 45 days and you wouldn't know it if you're doing a monthly financial review, say, on the 15th of the trailing month.
Mm-hmm.
When you create a scorecard, what is the human activity? What is the physical thing? So how many phone calls did you make to prospective clients? Or, you know, back to the website, how many hits this week did we do? I don't know. How much money did we spend to get those hits? Was mm-hmm. it a good ROI? Was the click-through good, right? What's the bounce rate? If mm-hmm. you're tracking stuff as it's happening, you know, again, some of those things could be lagging in nature, but on a weekly basis, if you figure out what is the human activity, when my people do this thing right here, whatever that thing is, let's measure how many times we do that thing, and then we'll be able to figure out the business results a week or two, six, 10 down weeks down the road.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you're actually lucid to what your people are doing and how it moves that needle. So if you're in e-commerce, traffic has a lot to do, right? But if a million people come to your site and 999,999 bounce because the landing page isn't right. You should test some landing pages this week. How about five?
Mm-hmm.
Every week, you should A-B test five things on your website. If you're constantly refining and testing new ideas and finding winners, that's very forward-looking. That's very proactive. And again, when we track those activities, the business result you're looking for almost always happens versus just waiting for this thing to happen or not happen and having an opportunity for a million things to go wrong during that journey, and then only learning it with hindsight as the benefit versus, you know, real time. So it's a mindset shift again, but forward-looking metrics that are, you know, one set of eyeballs, one human owns this metric, whatever that is, usually department head, right? Somebody that's, an expert in that part of the business. And you set a goal. The goal's 10 and you got 9 for the week. We're going to drop that down and we're going to discuss why your number's off track. If it's at 12, you get a high five. Thanks.
You know?
And then we move on. And that's, you know, rather than talking again about what's popular or comfortable, we're just having the conversations of what's not working. We don't need to spend a lot of time what's working. That feels good. But there's a lot of stuff that's not working. So it allows us to really vector our time and focus on those things. And when you do that, your business improves, dramatically.
Right. Because now you're looking at controlling the controllable factors. That's the best way that I can put it. You can't necessarily control how many people come into your business, but you can control the activities that might bring those people in. So that's, man.
Yeah, because you said it better than I did. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
That's a great tip for, I think, anybody doing anything service or product based. I kind of wanted to change gears a little bit and just ask you a little bit more about, writing the book. Like, when did you, you've had a successful career, you've got a lot of experience, you've dabbled in different places, you've worked with a whole lot of different people, but, a lot of people have experience and they don't write books. Like, when did you realize that you had a book in you?
Well, I had a couple of clients that are like, hey, when are you going to write a book? I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, this is like some of these stories you have, your approach to this. I think other people would benefit. So I really think you should write a book. Two or three clients told me that all within a couple of months. And I thought, well, I'm definitely full time doing a lot of, travel at the time. And you can stare at the bulkhead on an airplane, or you can get on your laptop and bang out a chapter, or half a chapter, during the segment in the air. So, I just really thought it was time. I thought there was a book in there, and didn't know if I had it in me or could get it done. But that's what great editors and designers are for, right? Editing without the editors I worked with, I don't think the book would have been all that good. So, it's about having an idea, asking people, and certainly if people are telling you there's value in it, that's a good idea. And then just surrounding yourself with people that, know what's good, what's not good, and being open to, I'd have a conversation with the editor and they're, states away, a local one, used a bunch of people, and they're tiptoeing around, and I just have to say on the phone, hey, yeah, does this kind of suck? And, well, yeah, it kind of does. Okay, great. Let's just tell me that, and how can we fix this? So it's about being humble and being open, not having all the answers, and really relying on professionals that say, hey, that's really good. Could you write some more about that? That's intriguing. And, you just got to be a student, being a first time author, but there's a lot of great programs out there, outlines on the internet. You can do print on demand. It's anyone can write a book. The barriers to writing a book have really, really come down. And, even if it takes you 14, 15 months to write the book, that's how long it took me from start to having a book in my hand. That's a lot of nights. It's a lot of weekends. It's a lot of flight. It's definitely other parts of your life. You're going to miss out on a few things, but the juice is definitely worth the squeeze. So I'd recommend it to anyone who thinks they have something to share with the world.
Right. And I feel like it goes a long way for, and a lot of different reasons. But personally, it's like a highlight tape that an athlete would put together, because, you know, these are your thoughts and experiences that have been, you know, aggregated over time. And while you could, yeah, you could sell it and all of that stuff, but I think the greater value is more just having that almost anthology of your life experiences and stuff, and putting it all together in one, you know, binding or whatever you would call it. But it's interesting to hear about those transferable skills, because you spoke earlier about, you know, even when you're leading yourself, you have vendors and you have clients and you have other people who you have to be able to communicate with clearly, have to be able to work with, have to be able to, you know, get your vision into their mind so that they can effectively work towards it and coordinate with you. So do you think that naturally, because of, you know, your disposition, your training and things like that, you might have been at an advantage to,
I would say that's fair to say, you know, but at the end of the day, you know, whoever gets the credit, right, to put me in those conditions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd be remiss not to mention, you know, a lot of the mentors and the people that took a chance on me and, mm-hmm. and gave me a perspective I didn't currently possess and challenged me.
Right.
And, pushed me along the way. And there were a lot of people, right? You know, Boy Scout leaders and family members and teachers, right? You know, some teachers motivated me to do good things, and other teachers motivated me to do other things. But, you know,
right.
at the end of the day, we are products of our environment. And that's why if you, you know, have young people around you, it's important to, you know, mentor them and help shape them. Somebody's going to put something in their ear. Why don't you put something positive, you know, something mm-hmm. valuable in there and see what happens. You got to send the elevator back down for the next generation, if you achieve any kind of success in the world today. And the more you give, the more you get. So that's just a mindset, right?
I totally agree with that one. That's huge, because we're in a position of, we've received many blessings to make it to where we're at. So it's only right to pay it forward. I think that's something that we could all do. So I guess I got a couple last questions that I really wanted to ask you, because I know a lot of people out there listening, they may have skills, or, you know, they work in a profession where they're gathering a lot of experience, but to branch out and to get into their own consulting and things like that, the way you have been building your own business around the knowledge base that you have been able to, you know, acquire over time, what was that like for you?
Well, I mean, most of the lessons I learned, right, were on somebody else's dime, you know. So in your 20s and your 30s, right, are where you should be listening more than you're speaking. And you know, really modeling behaviors, finding, you know, seeking mentors out, you know, doing all kinds of stuff for them for free that are unpleasant. And, I mean, there's hard work, right? No one's going to just, you know, hit you with a magic wand and give you everything you need. So just understanding that it's up to you. You're in charge here. The cameras are rolling. We're on. This is live. It's not a dress rehearsal. This is your life. So what are you doing to be intentional about that? And you know, it makes sense to work for someone else to get the skills. But once you have the relationships, once you have the skills, you have the financing, because you haven't been living like your other coworkers, right? Which is paycheck to paycheck. You've said no to a lot of things so you can have a business account. And as soon as, you know, the activities that you spend on the nights and the weekends on your side hustle, as soon as your time is worth more there than it is during your work, your main work day, then it's time to transition. So it's just time versus money. And if you want to be intentional about leaving the employment of another and starting your own thing, you know, you got to be smart about it. And you also need to be respectful in that transition, knowing that, you know, 80% of businesses fail in the first 4 or 5 years. You know, you shouldn't ignite any bridges anywhere. Mm-hmm. Your reputation of how you leave will be kind of the same of how you start and who you'll be. So just understanding that you treat everybody the right way all the time. It's okay to have plans past what you're doing, but you also need to be respectful and be fully present, you know, when you're being paid to do your main job, you know. So just how you do it, I think, is critical to your future success. And there's nothing wrong with going into your boss's office to say, hey, just so you know, I like it here a lot, but I've got plans to do my own thing in a year or two. So I'm just letting you know that. I don't want the promotion. You know, I want to continue to learn, but I don't see myself here in 5 years. Please don't take offense. That's just not my path. If your path is here in 5 years, good for you. That's just not what I'm looking for. A lot of people, maybe that's not prudent based on their culture or their relationships to say that. But at the end of the day, you know, people are being paid for this amount of work. It's a very transactional thing. As long as you provide what you're being paid for and you're not using that opportunity to further your opportunity, you know, unethically, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, and I think that should be applauded when people are, you know, open and honest and upfront about their intention.
Right. And man, you said that right. I know that there's a lot of hard work to do regardless of where you're at, whether it's school, a part-time job. There's always experience to gain, something to learn, and a mentor there to offer some kind of words of wisdom. So as we wind this down, because I really want to understand, I know I'm going to give you like a question that we ask pretty much all of our guests, okay? And it's not a trick question, but I want to understand kind of how you look at yourself. So you have superpowers, all right? Because not like magic powers, but like real superpowers, as in everywhere you go, you're making a big difference. You're helping people. You're building organizations stronger than they ever knew they could be. You know, you're a father, you're a husband. You're doing all of these great things, but what is the skill that allows you to be most effective at what you do?
I would say my commitment to those things you listed. You know, I'm not interested in any of those things. I'm committed to be good at all those things you listed, right? So when you're interested in something and adversity strikes, you'll find something else to be interested in pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. When you're truly committed to being, you know, any of those things, all those things, some of those things, depending on, you know, who I'm talking to, that's where it really comes down to. You'll find a way around it, through it, over it, under it, doesn't matter. There's it's just problems and solutions out there, right? So I would just say being really committed. Now, there's some drawbacks to be, you know, blinders on committed. But at the end of the day, if I wasn't super committed to be those things, you know, I just couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you got to be bought in all the way to get the results that you've been achieving, most definitely. So,
right. I joke with my clients all the time. Hey, you can't be half pregnant on this decision, right? You either are or you are not. There's right. No maybe.
Exactly.
You know, I think it's Steve Chandler talks about, he draws three circles, like a Venn diagram. Mm-hmm. On one, it says, hell yeah. On the other, it says, hell no. And then the middle, the interlapping one, it says, hell, with little flames on it. And that's a Steve Chandler thing. But I just love that because that's just so true, right? It's so easy to say, hell yeah, let's do this, or hell no, let's not do that. It's when you're stuck in the middle, and that's my point about commitment.
Right.
When you're like super, super committed to something, chances of you getting there are much greater.
Man, that is, I love that. That's good. I'm stealing that one also. All right. So let's just say you've got the whole next generation of great leaders, you know, next generation of parents, super athletes, entrepreneurs, creative minds, you know, politicians, all of them, they're out there. They're getting ready to, who knows, they might be 8 years old, they might be 18, they might be 38, and they're just getting started. Who knows how old they are, but you got the next generation of great leaders out there and they're listening to you. You got 60 seconds on the mic. What kind of advice are you going to give them?
Well, back to what you said earlier about the five people you surround yourself with, young people right now today, you know, that it's critical. The pack you run with, the people you surround yourself with, what your personal values, what you're willing to do and not do, you know, if you're committed to be something, surround yourself with people that have that level of commitment. and a mastermind group, like a peer group. You know, I'm a huge fan of like Entrepreneurs Organization, Young Presidents Association, Vistage, Ascender. There's all these great peer groups in my local market. And when I see these entrepreneurs surround themselves with other entrepreneurs that, you know, they're in a different business, doing different things, different size companies, different places in their journey, but they're all feeling the same things. And that's the place where those business owners can go and speak openly, honestly, and learn through other people's experience. You don't have to make the mistake that's right around the corner for you because somebody else has already been there. So get yourself a mastermind. Surround yourself with people that want what you want, and be really protective of that community. And I think that'd be the advice I'd give somebody is, you know, an old mentor told me years ago, he said, Hallberg, you can't fly with the eagles if you're hanging out with the turkey.
Ooh, yeah, that's a rough one. But hey, that's great advice. I definitely subscribe to that. I believe it. And, you know, you're living proof. If you say it, I believe it too. So, ladies and gentlemen, Chris Hallberg, author of Business Sergeant's Field Manual. Chris, where can people connect with you online?
My website is www.bizsgt.com. Books available there and on Amazon.com. And if people are interested in learning more about EOS or the Entrepreneurial Operating System, my website for that is www.tractioninc.com, TRACTIONINC.com.
Awesome. Well, hey, it's been really great chatting with you today. I appreciate the wisdom, man. I took a lot out of the book, but even more out of the conversation. So everybody, I suggest go check it out. Look my man up. You're going to learn a lot. Chris, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on, and really enjoyed the conversation.